This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. In the 8 days since three people were murdered and two injured in the lobby of the Fifth Third Bank, we have learned more about the shooter, Omar Santa Perez. Most troubling is that the family of the 29-year-old, who was shot and killed by police, appealed to the courts to commit Santa to mental health treatment. If the courts had complied, Santa Perez would have been banned from buying a gun legally in Ohio. But that didn't happen. And once again, we're left entangled in a debate over mental illness and access to guns. To review what we have learned and how this incident might inform ongoing debates about gun control in Ohio, we are joined by Cincinnati Enquirer reporter Jesse Vollmert. And if you would like to join our discussion, you can call 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. We're also on Twitter and Facebook. Jesse, welcome back to Cincinnati Edition.
Thanks for having me.
The mix of federal and state laws that control the whole gun, mental health and gun access, it can be very confusing. And just to be clear here, we're talking about two states at least, Florida and Ohio, and the federal government. How would you put that mix of laws together? How would you describe that?
Well, I think I described it as complicated because it is. And the challenge is you're trying to balance some competing interests. You're trying to balance individuals' rights, Second Amendment rights to access firearms, and one in five individuals have some sort of mental health condition or issue within a given year. And so there are a lot of people with mental health concerns, and certainly most of them are not dangerous at all. And so you don't want to imply everyone with a mental health diagnosis is going to be dangerous and shouldn't have access to a firearm. But there are certainly people like Mr. Santa Perez who relatives begged the courts to commit to mental health treatment. And he still was able to legally purchase a firearm in Cincinnati years later.
So in the case of his family, as I understand it, they went to court in Florida, in Palm Beach County, and went at least twice. Do we really know what happened in those court proceedings?
So we are trying to find out as much as we can about those court proceedings. And so, no, we don't know everything. Right now, we know that at least two occasions while he was in Florida between 2010 and 2012, relatives went to the court and the court ordered these ex parte orders, which essentially were a mental health evaluation. In both Florida and Ohio, you are allowed to commit someone to a mental health examination for up to 72 hours without that person being added to the system that bans you from having a firearm. That might have been what happened in Florida 8 years ago. It could have also been the case that he should have been added to that list, and through, court not reporting it properly, it didn't get into the system. That's what we're still trying to find out. My colleagues have spoken with the judge in the case and the judge over the mental health court down in Florida, and just don't remember the specifics of one case that happened all those years ago. So we're still looking for records on that.
So if, okay, they can recommend someone for an evaluation, but if they're not committed for, as I understand it, if they're not committed for more than 3 days, for 72 hours, a person would not be added to the national list. Is that correct? So you could, actually, he could have gotten an evaluation, or he may have done it technically voluntarily, not by the order of the court, just the recommendation of the court. And in both of those cases, if he didn't stay 72 hours and he wasn't committed by the court order, he might not have been eligible to be added to the national criminal background check. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. And so you can easily see places where this might have fallen through the cracks. The federal law, which all the states are bound by, requires for a person to be added to this national database of people who are banned from having firearms. They need to either be, involuntarily committed or determined by the court to have a mental health issue. That could be in a case where somebody's found not guilty by reason of insanity. Also some cases when people are found not competent to stand trial, to proceed with court proceedings because they don't understand what's going on. But that's even a little iffy talking with the officials in Ohio. And so Florida in 2010 had laws very much like what we have now, where a person could be committed for up to 72 hours, and if they go voluntarily, they wouldn't be added to this list. Florida has since added some more strict rules. In 2013, they cracked down on people who were going voluntarily, saying that if a doctor says your condition is so severe that you would have been sent here involuntarily, those person could be banned from having a firearm. And then more recently, after the shooting in Parkland, Florida, they passed what's called a red flag law. And that essentially allows relatives or police to petition the court to temporarily remove firearms from an individual.
So I want to talk more about that red flag law in a second, but just to pursue this national list, if a person appears on that list and you're going to a legitimate gun shop, not buying off the street or something, but you're going to the shop owner will check that list. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. And that's the method that Cincinnati police has told us was used in this case. Santa Perez went to a local firearm shop on August 2nd, I believe, and purchased the gun that was used in this shooting.
Any sense of how often a person actually isn't allowed to buy because their name pops up and they're told, no, you can't get a gun? How often that happens? So in other words, does this list actually work in some cases?
It does work in some cases. I don't have the specific numbers off the top of my head, but the FBI does track the denials. The most common reason people are denied access to a firearm or purchasing a firearm is because of a prior felony conviction. That is one reason why you might not be able to purchase a gun. Or federal law also prevents misdemeanor domestic violence convictions from obtaining a gun. If you might be under an indictment, if there's a warrant for your arrest, these are all reasons why you might be added to that list, regardless of mental health.
Let's just very quickly, because this doesn't exist in Ohio, but in Florida it does, as a result of what's happened in Florida in the past year, the red flag law. And this is a little bit different. It looks like it has, from what I've been able to read about it, has some teeth to it. How does that operate?
Yeah, essentially how it works is if a relative or a police officer is concerned about a person thinking that they might be a danger to themselves or to other people, they can go to a court and request that the firearms be removed from that person. It is a temporary thing that the person could get them back, but it is seen as a check on situations like what happened with Mr. Perez.
You know, I did see that in some report, 450 people have been ordered to surrender their arms under that new law, that brand new law in Florida. So it... Governor Kasich here in Ohio has been pressing for some new gun laws. Is anything in that package that the governor is pushing, does any of it deal directly with some of the issues we're talking about today, the mental health, strengthening the mental health provisions, or a red flag law, or anything like that?
So, yes, a red flag law is one of the items that is included in this package of changes that John Kasich is pushing after this bipartisan group that he got together recommended several changes. And so that is one thing that he is pushing for. Democrats, prior to John Kasich making this announcement, had been pushing for that after the shooting in Florida. It is not seeing a lot of action in Columbus. Right now, lawmakers aren't in session because they are campaigning, and so they probably won't be back until the fall.
Well, I know that they're not in session, and therefore there's a problem with asking this question, but you track Columbus pretty closely. Is there any indication because of this shooting in Cincinnati, which was in Ohio, you know, 8 days ago, that there is some, you know, something has shifted, the discussion in any way has shifted over future law, future legislation that's packaged by Governor Kasich? Any more energy behind that because this brings it that much closer to home?
It's difficult to say right now, but you got to imagine this is something that's going to come up in the fall. You got to imagine this is something that lawmakers are going to point to as an example of a situation very close to home where something like this could have helped. It's hard to say if it would have absolutely helped, but having more tools is always something law enforcement talks about.
Is there anything else that you have sort of learned or delved into that you'd want to share with us that I didn't ask the right question before we leave here?
I think what was interesting to me, at least, was Ohio's laws are very similar to what Florida's laws were back in 2010 when Santa's family was asking for him to have some mental health treatment. And so while states like Florida have made some changes, Ohio is pretty close to what it has always been, and that has been interesting. It's not necessarily surprising. Recently, Ohio lawmakers have been very committed to more and more gun access, and very few laws are, if any laws are passing, to restrict access to firearms.
So even before this incident in Cincinnati at the Fifth Third Lobby, there wasn't a lot of energy behind the Kasich proposals. Is that fair to say?
That is fair to say. We spoke with Speaker Ryan Smith, the new speaker, and he said that his caucus, the Republicans, were more supportive of a Stand Your Ground law than John Kasich's package in its entirety. I think you might see them pick off some of the items that are a little bit easier to approach. There's one thing about banning armor-piercing bullets, which are already banned by the federal government. But something like that you could see passing a little bit easier than this red flag law, which there are concerns that relatives would use it to just take guns away from people.
Okay. Well, I want to thank Jesse Ballmert for being here and for the reporting you've been doing over the last week, a little bit more than a week, on this whole issue. And we'll talk to you in the future. Okay. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. Last spring, Cincinnati Council was firm. They would not pay more than $274,000 to Harry Black when he agreed, under pressure, to resign. This week, the city agreed to pay an additional $370,000 to short-circuit the cost of a threatened lawsuit from Harry Black. That's $644,000 in all. The $644,000 is hard for many people to take, but this has also resurfaced concern about the charges Black made against the mayor. To discuss these and other developments at City Hall, I'm joined by Cincinnati Business Courier reporter and columnist Chris Wetterich. If you would like to join our discussion, call 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org, or we're on Facebook and Twitter. Chris, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Dan.
What was the justification for this pretty sizable $370,000 additional settlement here?
Well, you got to remember that the first settlement, which was basically 8 months' pay and some accrued vacation and some other random amounts of money. That was not – Harry Black never agreed to that, right? That was a provision, the ordinance that city council passed in the hopes that he would resign before they fired him. And they were going to fire him because Greg Landsman, of course, had switched his vote from the Gang of Five to the Gang of Four. And so they were ready to fire him. The morning of the meeting, which was a Saturday morning, Harry Black was sitting in his office, and minutes before the meeting started, he emailed his resignation in, and that was that. He never agreed to that amount, and he said in his resignation letter that that he reserved the right to sue. And that is what he threatened to do in a letter in May. And it outlines some things that that he had kind of previously alluded to regarding Mayor Cranley. And what the city decided to do was, you know, it said, look, we're going to have to hire an outside law firm because the solicitor's office employees might be called as a witness. So we'll have to hire an outside counsel to defend ourselves against this Harry Black lawsuit. And of course, lawyers charge hundreds of dollars an hour. And when they did up the math, not only on that, but also remember the solicitor's office has to defend Harry Black in the lawsuits against the city by employees such as, you know, police officer Jeff, or he's not a police officer, he's a high ranking captain, Jeff Butler. So, you know, Harry is the subject of those lawsuits as well. So they might have to hire outside counsel to defend him in those suits as well. So the amount of money that we're talking about in outside lawyers was such that the city manager, the acting city manager, Patrick Duhaney, decided that, you know, we need to pay this and move on.
Well, you know, Dave Mann said that the financial exposure that the city had was, quote unquote, enormous.
Right.
What did Harry Black have that was so powerful?
You know, and I'm not quite sure. We should have probed David a little bit more on that and whether he was talking about the law firm costs or whether the treatment of the former city manager was what he was referring to. I suspect it's a combination of both. So the manager, the former manager, accused the mayor of is basically putting his finger on the scale on economic development deals in favor of developers. He made a specific allegation that in some instances the mayor had increased the subsidy, the city subsidy of deals or the tax abatements. And so that was kind of a new thing that we had not heard previous to this letter being released through a public records request that the Business Courier made.
So, you know, when Cranley had left council as a member of council before he was elected mayor 5 years ago, I mean, he was a developer. He was developing
Correct.
Out in on the west side of town.
And he did legal work for developers
and
at KMK
work
Law.
So, you know, how do you even research that in the sense that, well, of course he had those connections.
Right.
And one could read it, and I think that the mayor would argue this, that gave him an advantage. He understood how deals were put together.
Sure.
And that the mayor weighing in was a smart thing for the city.
That's exactly his argument. You know, the city manager also accused the mayor of stepping over the bounds in the charter, not only on personnel matters, but which, of course, the city manager has complete control of, according to the charter, but also on these development deals. The mayor says, no. The charter allows me to refer legislation, and whenever we do an economic development deal, that is a piece of legislation that I refer to council. So I'm required to get involved in that. That is his stance on this issue. He has some expertise in that area, and he views that as an advantage. He also has taken an enormous amount of campaign contributions from developers in this town. He's loaded up his campaign accounts through limited liability companies of these developers, and they can basically give a nearly unlimited amount, in terms of as many LLCs as they have, they can max out each donation on that. So that's, you know, that's another consideration. He is very, very connected to the development community.
Now that this settlement has been made, do you see there were some council people who were saying, well, we got to pursue the charges against the mayor? Do you actually see that happening?
No, I don't. And that's because the people that have said, hey, look, we need to hire outside counsel. We need to take a look at this. You know, they're typically people who are viewed as critics of the mayor, although Tamaya Denard has never picked fights with Cranley in the way that another person who said, we need to take a look at this, Wendell Young, has. But she's somebody who I think you'd describe as somebody who's kind of a skeptic of the mayor. David Mann, I think I should note his quote on this. He said that this has to be evaluated in terms of the terrible relationship between the mayor and Mr. Black and Mr. Black's self-interest in presenting as unflattering and derogatory allegations about the mayor as possible. In the absence of more specific claims, we all need to move forward to address this city's problems. I see no public benefit in wallowing in the agonies of the Cranley Black dysfunction. That's a quote that I had from him that we haven't actually published yet. But so I think you have a divided council. A lot of people feel the way that, Mr. Mann does. I don't think they're going to ever get to the votes where they would have someone come in and, address this or look at this.
Back in the spring, something that the mayor and the manager had agreed on for a separation was $424,000.
Correct.
And people went, oh, no, we're not paying that much.
There was not a majority for it.
And there was some real energy behind that no. Mm-hmm. Looking back on that, that looks like a pretty good deal financially at this point.
You know, it's important. Let's dig into the numbers a little bit. The settlement that was proposed back in the spring, the $424,000, that was a lump sum payment. But he still would have gotten his accrued vacation and some various other things. And so his lawyer actually, in a subsequent letter to the city, estimated that the value of the $424,000 plus vacation and whatever else he was entitled to was really about $603,000. So it was about $41,000 less than what he actually ended up getting. So
it's not as big a difference as it first looks.
It looks bad on the surface, but it's a rounding error in some respects. It's a real rounding error when it comes to the city's budget. So,
well, that's a question I've got. There is some sort of fund to pay when the city is sued. So, does it's a big sizable settlement here. Does this in fact impact the operational budget that the city faces? Or do they now face a problem of cuts or something because of this?
I don't think so. And it's important to remember why this didn't require council's approval. There's a fund passed in each budget each year that allows the city manager to make legal settlements, not only with disgruntled employees or people who have had stuff flood into their basement from MSD. And so that's where he took the money from. It's in the budget. They may have to replenish it later on. I'm not sure there's much left, but and that's why you had no vote on this at city council. And actually, I think a majority probably verbally told the city manager they were okay with this. I say that because Wendell Young, who was against a settlement early on, told the manager, you know what, I'm not for wasting people's money, and it's clear that we're going to do that here, so I'm okay with it.
So in the process of negotiating this deal, they did go around and talk to people. It didn't come to a full vote, but they did talk to council people.
Correct. Individually, they polled them.
What does all this say about the proposal on that will appear on the ballot to allow for executive sessions to deal with issues of personnel? Because one of the things that happened here is this just exploded into the public and made it that much more difficult to deal with.
You know, the members of council who voted for that, and every single one of them did except for Vice Mayor Smitherman, will tell you this Harry Black situation is exactly why they need executive session, because they need to be able to meet in private and discuss the situation and avoid the public bloodbath that occurred. And of course, the opposite side is we have people who say, including reporters, admittedly, that our government requires an unparalleled amount of transparency. There's rarely a local government that can't go into executive session, and in this case, the city of Cincinnati is not one of them. So.
It's one of the few.
It's one of the few. And some people say it might look messy, but at least our business is being done in public.
Yeah. Well, it does look messy sometimes.
It does.
Yeah. So we do have a caller, Tom, and I want to get him in. We're going to run out of time. But Tom, what is your question or observation?
Hi. I'm calling because I know that the mayor was asking for personal meetings with developers in order to approve their tax abatements. And in our meeting, he didn't ask for a donation or anything, but it was obviously a perfect point for people to offer donations to his campaign.
So how do you know that?
Well, because he asked for personal private meetings with developers for any tax abatement that was asked for. I mean, like I said, he did not specifically ask for a donation. He was smart enough not to do that, but he made it in a private meeting in his own office with no one else available. I'm certain lots of developers just decided, in order to make sure that they got their tax abatement, they offered him a donation.
I don't know about the latter part of your statement, Tom, but I have reported before, and I know what you're talking about, in that the mayor requires developers from the smallest projects to the largest ones to come meet with him to talk about their project before that item is voted on by city council. So the first part of your statement I know to be true. The second part, I have no idea.
Okay. Well, Chris, I want to thank you for being here today.
Thank you, Dan.
coming in with these explosive little stories that have all kinds of implications and go a lot of different directions. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. On Monday, we focused on what's holding up the implementation of Ohio's medical marijuana law passed 2 years ago. In Kentucky, advocates and lawmakers from both sides of the aisle are preparing for another push to pass a medical marijuana bill. More immediately, the issue of pulling back Medicaid expansion looms while voters prepare to weigh in on Congress in a few weeks and politicians jockey for position in next year's races statewide. To shine a light on Kentucky politics, we are joined now by Kentucky State House reporter for the Associated Press, Adam Beam, political reporter for the Lexington Herald, Daniel DeRochers, and the editor and publisher of River City News, Michael Monks. To join our discussion, you can call 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Welcome, everybody.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, it's good to have you here. Daniel DeRocher, let's start with you. The debate about medical marijuana in Kentucky, it's been going on for years. This is not new. Do party lines tell us anything about who supports this in Kentucky and who doesn't? Is that a worthwhile way to begin to parse what's going on?
I don't know that it's party lines so much as the type of people that they represent. I mean, there are some Republicans who obviously support medical marijuana legislation, one of them being Senator Dan Stein. He introduced a bill last session. It's definitely it has become a cause for Democrats. A lot of Democrats are kind of campaigning on this and are talking about the need for it. The biggest being Secretary of State Allison Lundigan Grimes. She set up a task force last year. I think it really comes down to the internal politics of both parties, of the legislature as a whole. If this thing is going to get passed, it really needs to have support of the leadership in both the Senate and the House. And that's a question of one, their constituents, whether or not their constituents support it, and two, whether or not they can get the bulk of the Republican caucus in the legislature to support this type of legislation.
And right now, where do you think the leadership is?
I don't know for sure. I haven't done too much research on this lately. I've been kind of okay. Caught up in campaign season.
Is that going on too? Okay.
yeah.
we'll come back to that in a minute. Michael Monks, how does this medical marijuana issue, how does this cut with the Northern Kentucky delegation?
It's going to be interesting to watch where the Northern Kentucky Legislative Caucus lands on this issue should it come for a formal vote at any point. We know that there are several members of the Northern Kentucky Legislative Caucus on the committee that's hearing pros and cons on the legalization of medical marijuana. In fact, Diane St. Onge, a Republican from Fort Wright, is co-sponsor of this legislation. So she's in favor of it. But we heard most recently from Republican Representative Kim Moser of Taylor Mill. She's the former drug czar of Northern Kentucky, which had a big focus on the opioid crisis. Mm-hmm. But in one of my interviews with her, she spoke very much against any type of legalization for marijuana, and in fact held a forum to talk about the dangers of the use of marijuana
just
broadly.
Just this morning, right?
Exactly. So she's probably a no on this. And Senator John Schickel, a Republican from Boone County who has a background in law enforcement, he was the jailer out there, and you see the law enforcement community not very much in favor of this sort of thing. So, but those are all Republicans. So you see that there is a little bit of a divide even within the same party.
Okay. Adam Beam, I want to move on beyond the medical marijuana question to the question of Medicaid and where we stand with this in Kentucky at the moment. And in the recent past here, been a lot of things being said. One of them, that the 480,000 people approximately who are on the expansion of Medicaid are optional. That didn't go over well. Where do we stand on this? Because the governor wanted to do certain things. That hasn't happened. So where do we really stand right now?
We're still in a wait-and-see mode. Basically, the federal judge in Washington, D.C. has blocked Governor Bevin's proposed reforms, which would have required some Medicaid recipients to have a job or volunteer in order to keep their benefits and also to pay monthly premiums. Now, that what's happening now is the state is trying to get its waiver, its permission to do these things, reapproved, because basically the judge said they didn't use the right process to get the waiver approved. They didn't consider all of the factors they should have considered. Namely, they did not consider the impact that it would have on the thousands of people who would lose their insurance. So they're going through the whole process again and trying. They believe that they have a way that they can go through this process again that would satisfy the judge so that the waiver would then be allowed to be put in place.
What do they have to demonstrate in that situation? I mean, if people are there, the goal is to get a significant number of people off of the Medicaid rolls. So,
that was the goal originally. Governor Bevin and members of his administration said their goal was they wanted to shrink Medicaid because they wanted to take people off Medicaid, not to have them have no insurance, but their goal was to move them into private insurance. And they wanted to create a program that they view as sort of like a training ground, training people on what it's like to have private insurance and then move them off into private insurance. They've kind of since changed their tune on that. Now they're saying, you know, the goal is not to shrink Medicaid, I think for that very reason, because they know that they're having problems with the judge who says that by doing that, they're having, you know, they're not taking into regard the impact it will have on people if they were to lose Medicaid, which brings us to the Secretary Adam Meyer, who's Governor Bevin's Health and Family Services Secretary, who's testifying to lawmakers, and he made the quote that you referenced earlier,
right,
that the Medicaid expansion population is an optional population. And what he meant by that is that the medical federal law requires Medicaid to cover certain people. There are other populations that it is an option to cover them, and the state can decide whether they want to cover them or not. The expanded population is, quote, technically an optional population in the sense that the state is not required to cover them. And Adam Meyer, Secretary Meyer, was telling this to lawmakers because they were asking him about a huge deficit, a $300 million projected shortfall that the state has in its Medicaid program over the next 2 years. And they said, what are we going to do to fix this? And he said, well, we had hoped to fix it by implementing this controversial waiver, and that we would have saved money. But if we can't do that, then we might have to consider ending the expansion because the expansion is optional. But, of course, some people took that to mean that the people in the population were optional, right, and they, of course, took great offense at that.
That was not good. One of the things that in reading a number of the articles that various people have written is that it seems that almost one-third of all Kentuckians are covered by Medicaid. That is a huge percentage of the state population. Daniel, what do you say about that? I mean, that is a big coverage group.
Yeah, that sounds a little high, but I don't know the number exactly. But when you look at the Kentucky as a state as a whole, I mean, there's obviously been massive parts of throughout the state where there's been kind of poverty issues and when there's been health problems. And so with the Medicaid expansion, a lot more people were able to get access to this health care, to Medicaid. And it really increased the number of people in the state who have Medicaid. And it certainly makes us one of the larger states in the country in terms of having a large part of the population insured through this process.
Andy Beam, what do things look like in the 6th District with Representative Andy Barr and his opponent, Amy McGrath, which seems to be the most highly contested of the races? Now we're about 6 weeks out from the election. This is getting really down to the nitty-gritty. Where does that race really stand at this point?
Well, I certainly think it's tightening. You're starting to see a lot of the negative ads flying fast and furious. And especially telling is they're really coming from Representative Barr's campaign itself. So when an incumbent in a congressional race, or any race for that matter, starts running negative ads mentioning his candidate by name, that's a sign that the race is close. They have polling that shows the race is close, because usually if the incumbent is up, they don't want to put the opponent's name out there at all. And so what's been happening here lately is Representative Barr has been airing ads basically saying that his opponent, Amy McGrath, supports single-payer health insurance, a single-payer health care system. She does not support single-payer, so she has been pushing back against that. And then you have some outside groups that have been running ads against Representative Barr saying that he does not support veterans, that he is basically taking money from the payday lending industry, which is preying on veterans. And so he's allowing these payday lending groups to take advantage of veterans. And, of course, that's a big issue in this race because Amy McGrath is a retired Marine fighter pilot. She's a veteran herself. And so he's been pushing back on that. He's been sending letters to Lexington TV stations asking them to pull these ads. So they're really having a battle on the airwaves right now. And, you know, we're not going to really see the two of them together much. I think the only opportunity we might have, and Daniel, you might correct me if I'm wrong here, but the only opportunity we're going to have is a statewide debate aired on KET the week before the election. I think that's the only time that they've both agreed so far to be together to debate each other.
Daniel, is that right?
Yeah, there's still potential for one more debate on WKYT, but neither has accepted or declined that invitation yet.
How has, Daniel, how has the McGrath support for the Affordable Care Act, now that's different than single payer, but for the Affordable Care Act, she's been very clear on that. Has that resonated? Because that's a theme for Democratic candidates all over the United States this year. They're really hitting home on coverage for health care. So has that hit home in Kentucky?
Yeah, well, so that's been her primary issue throughout the campaign. She's really run on health care being her signature issue. A lot of that stems from the fact that Andy Barr was a big supporter of the Republican plan to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act, to the point where he was coming back and doing town halls as that legislation was being debated in Congress, and he was facing a lot of really angry constituents. And so she's tried to really kind of capitalize on that anger over the idea of having their Medicaid coverage taken away, and she's made that her signature issue. It's interesting that he chose to go after her on healthcare in that same vein and try to tie her to single payer, which is much less popular at this point in a district like the 6th Congressional District than the Affordable Care Act. So he's trying to tie her with a more liberal, more progressive plan rather than her actual position of just wanting to reform the issues with the Affordable Care Act and create things like a public option or allowing a Medicare buy-in for people who are older than 55.
You know, before I let Adam and Daniel go, because you have to move on to some other things, I just can't resist raising the point that Governor Bevin gave a speech basically defining the good things about indentured servitude and how it's sort of an earlier form of apprenticeship. It seemed really tone deaf to me. I mean, not to get into all the details, but seemed really tone deaf.
Well, this has been a problem with this governor. And I think this stems from the fact that he does not use prepared notes. He speaks, every speech he has is off the cuff, whether it is the State of the Commonwealth or, you know, speaking at a ribbon cutting. And he sometimes gets ahead of himself and says things that are problematic. The one that comes to mind before this is when, you know, he famously said he guaranteed that teachers who were, protesting these changes to the pension system, that their protests that ended up closing some schools, he guaranteed that a child was sexually assaulted because of that.
Yeah.
So he says things like this all the time without thinking. And then instead of coming back and really apologizing, he just kind of doubles down and goes forward. And so, you know, it's becoming an issue for him. It's interesting to see how this will impact the election going forward, especially now that everything he says is recorded. You know, anytime he's anywhere public, somebody's going to be following him around, filming him.
Right.
How is that going to How is he going to get away from that and try to explain some of the things he says? We don't know.
Well, that's next year's election, but yeah. We will be there. I want to thank Adam Beam and Daniel DeRocher for joining us today. Michael, let's take a look at some of the stories that you've been covering across the river in northern Kentucky. One is a place I grew up, a new city hall in Covington.
Yes.
We all know the old city hall because it's been completely refurbished into Hotel Covington, which has just become this huge attraction. Where is city government now?
Well, city government in Covington has been rather nomadic since the latter part of the 20th century. They moved into the Coppins building.
That's pretty long ago. Yeah.
So I guess it is pretty long ago now. I just had my 20-year high school reunion and I realized how long ago the 90s are. So, so Covington moved into the Coppins building, which we now know as Hotel Covington, in about 1989, 1990. And they moved into that building from the old JCPenney store on Pike Street. They moved out of the Coppins building back to the old JCPenney store. Of course, now it's been completely renovated. In the 2000s, it was used as a smoky old bingo hall. And now it's a really cool-looking, updated office building, but it has some infrastructure problems. It has some leaky roof issues. It's a little dark in there. So they're finally ready to find a permanent home for the first time in a long time. And they're not exactly sure where they're going to go. They're going to open it up to a lot of community feedback. I think that a lot of people in Covington have talked about looking at something similar to what Newport has. Newport's really the only city in the urban core in northern Kentucky that has all of its government operations in one newer building. And Covington doesn't have that. Covington has a city building, and then it has a building where its fire department is based. It has a building where its police headquarters are 20 blocks away, and its public works department is all the way out in Latonia. So if there's an opportunity to consolidate that, that's probably worth exploring. But they're going to have a series of forums for the public to weigh in on where City Hall should finally settle down after all these years.
Is there another department store that's available? No, I don't want to go
they're
there.
They're all filled up. You know, the old Sears is Braxton Brewery. The Parisian is a law firm. So they're repurposing all those old department stores well.
A lot of development issues in northern Kentucky that are going on right now. And let's just take a look at a couple of them. Ludlow, which is a river city, and everybody wants views of the river. That's developers want to be close to the water. That's not just locally, that's nationally. They just turned down a development, 72 units in Ludlow Yards, that seemed pretty favorable. What was the problem there?
Really strange development. So Ludlow, Covington, Newport, Bellevue, Dayton typically define the urban core in northern Kentucky. And because of Cincinnati's success in revitalizing its urban core, you're seeing a lot of similar developments pop up and come. You're seeing an extension of the success in Cincinnati pour over to the other side of the river. All the other cities, Covington, Newport, Bellevue, and Dayton, there are apartment buildings going up all over the place.
Yeah, I would actually suggest that some of that predate some of the things, and there have been times where Cincinnati's been trying to catch up.
Absolutely.
With Newport and Bellevue,
for sure. The cities have their own things going on that are inspiring to the other cities as well. Ludlow is so far the very first one to reject such a project, and they're the only ones without one going on. So here you have a city just like the other ones trying to revitalize its central business district, and they do have some really cool things going on in the city. And this project had been on the table for a long time, but it was shot down unanimously by city council after some organized outcry against the project. Some of the concerns about the Ludlow Yards project, the smallest concern was probably the aesthetic. That's becoming a common theme when any of these apartment buildings are presented. People decry the architecture, uninspired, too modern looking. It doesn't fit in with the historic fabric. So that's going to happen everywhere. But that was really the minimal concern. There was a lot of talk about the affordable housing component. Most of these units were going to have restricted income, but it wasn't low income. This was middle class, young professional income, but it was sort of either misunderstood or deliberately manipulated by some of the opponents to say this is going to be restricted for 30 years to attract what people assumed was Section 8 housing at the gateway to the city. Now they've decided to shoot it down. There is no plan for this large empty lot at the gateway to the city. And I don't know how they're going to recover from this because they may have harmed their reputation with developers as well. So that's going to be interesting to watch. They have a big election in Ludlow. I covered their meeting last night. It was a disaster. These people really don't like each other in the Ludlow City Building. And three seats for sure will be open. They've got a full field looking to replace all of them. It's going to be one of the wildest elections in Northern Kentucky this year.
Oftentimes people don't pay attention to Ludlow, but we should.
Well,
this
River
year.
City News does.
Well,
so.
I know River City News does. Let's go up the hill to Fort Mitchell.
Sure.
There's another development that you can only be understood, interestingly enough, some of the opposition, in terms of the Beechwood Schools.
That's right.
Which are one of the crown jewels in Northern Kentucky. And people are worried that you might build a building that has units that are too big.
That's exactly right. So there's a lot in Fort Mitchell on Grandview, and it's next to where the Kentucky Inquirer used to have its office back when they had an office in Northern Kentucky. They don't anymore, but that building, if you know where that is, that's the lot. And there's a developer who wants to put a nice-looking apartment building there with, I think, more than 100 units. And the community is upset, not because of the architecture. Fort Mitchell starts to be a little more suburban, so a little more flexibility with the types of new construction that goes on there. People are concerned that it will stretch the Beechwood School District too thin. Now, when you rank not just Northern Kentucky school districts, but across the entire state, you get Fort Thomas and Beechwood at the top of the list nearly every single time. They're in the top 3 to 5 school districts across the state. So Beechwood's a very competitive school district. Fort Mitchell's also a very expensive city to live in. So if you have the opportunity to rent an apartment and put kids in the school district that way, it may be something that families will pursue. However, some of the arguments seemed a little bit strange if you were watching the meeting, because there were suggestions that families might rent an apartment, not use the apartment, stay wherever else they live in Northern Kentucky or Cincinnati, just to have access to the Beechwood School District. Now, the developer himself says these apartments are not designed for families. These are smaller units. They're
very small.
They're small units, and they will have
700, 800 square feet.
Exactly right. So they've got some amenities that attract. They want young professionals and empty nesters. It's exactly the same message that you see in all the urban core apartment projects. It just happens to be in Fort Mitchell. But Beechwood is at capacity. They are concerned about having to put trailers in front of the buildings to educate this influx of kids that might come if this new apartment building is developed. So that's going to be an interesting to watch. There's been no official vote. There hasn't even been an official plan submitted to the planning department yet, but there has been some renderings, and there was a public meeting where the developer engaged with some of the citizens, and that's where these details came from.
We're running out of time, but here's a complicated one. Where do we stand with the IRS site in Covington? It's for all practical purposes, riverfront property, incredibly potentially valuable.
It's a year from now this month. So September of next year is when we expect the IRS flat top building to go away. And the city has decided to engage with a firm to help guide them on what the possibilities might be. So similar to the city hall situation, they're going to engage with the public. They're going to get as much analysis and feedback on what is possible at that site as they can. They're hoping through connections with Senator McConnell and other federal officials that the city will be able to get control over that site. But you know how government can work. There's a lot of governments involved with that site. And right now, no idea what's going to happen there. Yeah. But they're going to lose a lot of payroll revenue. Over $1 million in the city budget is going to be impacted. So it's a very serious affair.
Which is why it was built in the first place.
Exactly.
And why they basically gave it to the federal government back in the late 60s, early 70s. I want to thank Michael Monks from the River City News. It's online. Anybody can get to it. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. Segment producer, Layla Shakui. The technical director is Josh Elstro. Archives of our program are available on the website, wvxu.org. I'm Dan Hurley.